May the words of my mouth and the thoughts of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord. Good morning. I'm very, very pleased to have this chance to come and share with you and try to share some understandings with you, if I may. It's always a great pleasure to be asked to come and do this. And I would put it to you that when Hugh first raised this, much to my surprise in the middle of a session meeting, I looked around at the dates, and I was asked to do this once in 2002, I think it was, the week before Labor Day, and the week before Hugh arrived in our midst. So I looked at the date, and many of you will know that this is the week before Carrie Stover arrives in our midst. So I feel like I'm, I don't know, a John the Baptist, somebody's coming. It should be a wonderful day of expectation and looking ahead, and I'll refer to that in a few minutes. To start out today, I would ask you all, have you got any stresses in your life these days? I don't see anybody arguing with that one or saying, no, not me, no. There are things at home and at work. There's parenting, there's caregiving, there's coping with illness, and there's just plain bad luck. And there are what I call in life the left turns that take us by surprise. As was said to me a few weeks ago, man makes his plans and God laughs. We could call these things challenges, but most days we would just label them as stress. I asked some friends this week about their views or their recollections about stress. One said, stress is when you wake up screaming and then you realize you never really went to sleep. One said, most days I can't remember if I'm the good twin or the evil twin. One said, is it time for your medication or mine? And another said, I'm not tense, I'm just terribly, terribly alert. So let's talk about stress and where it comes from and what we do about it. But first, close your eyes and think about something that upset you yesterday. Okay, think about something about which you're worrying that will be coming tomorrow. And then I beg you, because I need you to listen to me, put those things out of your mind and come here and just be in the now. Be in these pews with your friends in the presence of this wonderful gathering place and in the presence of God. And then we start on a same page, and maybe we start with the stress of knowing that it's now. I'm going to examine two distinct verses from our reading today. Then I am going to explore a couple of responses that we have to the uncomfortable, what I call the gap. These are just a few views that I have put together about how we cope with stress. And finally, I will come back to this community, its hopes and its challenges for the year ahead. Not a small menu. I'll try to keep moving through it, but we'll see. Now, the passage from Matthew, and thank you, Giovanni. I think you read it with much more verve than I was going to, so it's wonderful. It's a comfortable passage. It's familiar. It's idyllic. But worry warts that we are it seems, come on, Jesus, this is out of touch. It doesn't quite ring true. But then that wandering rabbi was often out of touch with the world in which he was living. And it's one verse in this particular part of the reading that jumps out at me. Who of you, by worrying, can add a single hour to his life? Who of you, by worrying, can add a single hour to his life? And if you do anything when you leave here today, I want you to make a little promise to me that every day this week, you will say, at some point in the day, you will say that to yourself once. Make yourself think about worrying. Of course, in the passage, which has just before, Jesus has taught them how to pray, has taught them the Lord's Prayer. In this passage, he's setting up the comforting rhetoric of the remainder. Consider those lilies. What about the birds? But I want to hold on to this one central message in question. We all worry. We've admitted it today, live with stress. And I put it to you that it's the gap, it's the unknown, which is the root of worry. And the way we define the unknown as our life passes is by time. To me, and I think to all of us, there are three spaces in time that we can inhabit. The past is not really scary. We can actually describe what was there and what happened, what took place. It may be rushing by, but the present is not really a scary thing. We can make decisions that are interactive with our world. We can turn right, turn left. We can laugh or we can cry. We can talk or we can be silent. So control is not something that we worry about a lot in the present. But the future, now that is our challenge. Did you know you were going to sell the house by today? The future was rolling out all week before you. Think of those things that rolled out all this week that were on our minds until something happened to make them go one way or another way. So it is the unknown, or what I call the uncomfortable, that worries us. A dear friend brought really the kernel of this sermon to me when she pointed out a phrase by Khalil Gibran. Our anxiety does not come from thinking about the future, but from wanting to control it. Our anxiety does not come from thinking about the future, but from wanting to control it. And that has stuck with me for many weeks, and has brought me here. Now let's turn to Paul in Hebrews as he deals with this territory of the unknown, because the last part of the reading was the classic in the Bible definition that Paul gives us. Faith is the substance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. The substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Consider the balance, and this is a beautiful rhetorical statement. Substance is matched with hope. Evidence is matched with not seen. Trying his best to comfort his listeners, the receivers of his letter, Paul holds out the tangible substance and evidence, things that we work with every day, things that we depend on and can pinpoint, so that they might find a bridge to the intangible, things hoped for and things not seen. From the known to the unknown. And throughout the remainder of this verse in Hebrews, Paul bombards the audience with success stories. Moses, Abraham, Noah, all the heroes of the Old Testament who triumphed because of one thing, because of faith, at times when worry and fear and the unknown stood before them. So where does worry reside? It resides in this uncomfortable gap between the known and the tangible, and the unknown and the intangible. Between the present and, by definition, the future, that worrisome part of time. We worry about trying to influence, to predict, to control. But, asks Jesus, what does it profit you to envelop yourself in this kind of stress? So what do we do in this gap, this zone? I want to turn now to two approaches which I've picked to see how we approach, how we try to solve, because we're human beings, we're intelligent, we try to get answers. And we turn to trying to make sense of things when we're wandering in a dark woods and can't see any path. One natural instinct is to try and define or name something that is alien, strange, or threatening. And here I want to turn to one of the people that I consider to be key in the Bible. That's Mary. No, not Mary, mother of Jesus, not that Mary. The other Mary, Mary Magdalene. Yes, this is a tough subject, and I didn't consult Hugh as to whether I could talk about it today. But stay with me, because I believe that there's a little nugget here that we can take away. So I will only scratch the surface of this tough subject. But I warn you, I want to make you curious, because I've always been curious. I consider Mary to be central to a lot of the message of the New Testament. And it turned out, as I will tell you now, for some of the wrong reasons. But I think that she is an essential figure in terms of piety and humanity. So skipping through all those uncomfortable thoughts that are running through your heads, I want to review what we know, the things we do know from reading and studying in the Old Testament, in the New Testament. Mary Magdalene is, or was, a historical person. She is mentioned 12 times in the Gospels. And that's a heck of a lot more than a lot of the other heroes in the story. She came from a fishing village of Magdalena on the shore of the Sea of Galilee. Mary was one of a group of women who, alongside the 12 named apostles, followed Jesus throughout the countryside. There are others that are named, Susanna and Joanna in the Gospels, but Mary is always named first, Mary Magdalene. Mary had an affliction referred to as seven demons, which was cured, exorcised by Jesus. Mary likely came from a prosperous family in that fishing village, and according to Luke, Mary used her means to finance the lives of the apostles and the women as they followed Jesus. Mary was present at the crucifixion. Mary was present at Jesus' burial. And of course, we know Mary was present at the tomb on Easter morning. Those are the facts. Those are known. If we accept Mary as a historical figure, we can study the Gospels, we can study the other literature, and we know these things about Mary. Now, let's put these things in context, because she is an uncomfortable person. We can't quite put her in place. And I think some of these are the reasons why. Here is a Jewish woman who leaves her family, perhaps a betrothal, to wander about the countryside in a distinctly male society. The two heroes of the early church are two men who? Peter? Well, I wouldn't say John as much as Paul. But John, there's another one, okay? Oh, and John the Baptist? Or John the Divine, okay. I would say, for these purposes, Peter and Paul, who are writing and acting and preaching and going forward. But neither of these men, who already face a huge challenge in preaching and converting Jews and Gentiles in the Roman world, neither of them have any use for women in their narrative. And to cause a little ruckus here, where were all the men during the Easter calamity? They weren't at the foot of the cross. That was a pretty dangerous place to be politically. But that's where we find that Mary, the mother of Jesus, and the women were. We know the problems that poor old Peter was having that night and in those days. And the rest were holed up in a room somewhere in town. It was Mary Magdalene who had to run from the tomb to tell them the news. It's very unsettling. It creates tension. Understanding Mary and explaining her presence in the Gospels does add stress to this biblical situation. Now, here's the nugget that I feel that I uncovered. First, what would you say if I told you that in 591, 5 centuries into the history of the church and of Christianity in the post-crucifixion world, Pope Gregory I decides to put some definition to all the Mary stories that are floating around. And he did 2 things. First of all, he mashed together Mary Magdalene with 2 other women, Mary of Bethany and the sinful woman. Both of those women who in the Gospels anointed Jesus' feet. And then he associated Mary's 7 demons with the 7 deadly sins, featuring, of course, lust, pride, covetousness. And voila! In Pope Gregory's sermon and in his writings, we have the harlot, the evil woman, as depicted for many centuries by the Catholic Church and many other storytellers and artists through the ages, right up to Andrew Lloyd Webber and Dan Brown. In this royal role, that fallen woman, Mary Magdalene, becomes a saint of the Catholic Church, representing penitence and repentance. A woman turning from her evil ways, her sordid history to follow and indeed proclaim the risen Christ. Number 2. Then, in 1969, we were alive when Pope Paul VI, in his revision to the general Roman calendar, instantly declares that the church no longer identifies or associates Saint Mary Magdalene with that Mary of Bethany or that sinful woman. Mary's feast day is July 22nd. Harlot or heroine? I urge you to go and do some further investigation. There is something in this story, something about how we cope, how we put meaning on something that is uncomfortable. We try to pigeonhole, and often we pigeonhole in a way that suits our purposes, because it's stressful to live in the gap with things uncomfortable. Well, on to another assignment, class. If you have not read Hugh's message in the Carillon, please do so. And this came to me while I was playing with these ideas and I had decided to look around, and there was Hugh, fresh off the press. This is just published to us. You may not be here today, but I'm bringing him into the conversation without his permission. Hugh speaks in his essay about horizons, pointing out that in uncomfortable situations, we are often forced to do waiting. We're forced to wait. And when we do so, we often try to rationalize, once again, and fixate on a future goal, a horizon to which we convince ourselves we are traveling. We want to be in motion. There's time again. Time is passing. So we invent something measurable, even though it's far off, even though it's not well discerned, in a horizon. When confronted with the known and the uncomfortable, when we're under stress, we use the tangible. But Hugh says there may be a price to this kind of measurement, to this kind of worrying. Sometimes, he says, the goal takes away from now. We are not where we are because we are invested in some future place or future time. Where we are can be neglected or even missed. Where we are today can be neglected or missed. He then goes on to identify another intangible mystery, love. Love, he writes, is not a goal that we create. Rather, it's a kind of horizon that moves toward us and finds us, sometimes unawares. He writes, love is a hopeful expectancy that changes your day and gives significance to your moments. You see yourself and others differently. When love is your horizon, you are bathed in a different light. There is not panic, but patience. Not a sense of things running down, so much as a sense of gathering richness. Now, if you hear in the words of our minister this morning some echoes of that reading, don't be surprised. Just be thankful that we do have a wise voice, a discerning person, an understanding shepherd walking amongst us in this community. And this brings me to another horizon, and I see this one really clearly after reading Hugh's message. Carrie is coming. We didn't invent this horizon. It's something that has been coming to us, a new ministry, a new person in our midst, a person that we called and felt called to us. But equally, this week, just as Hugh did so many years ago, Carrie is praying and thinking about where he is about to embark. We have worries, he has worries, and these two horizons are approaching. So I ask you, and I put it to you, that we must all be aware of this in the coming weeks. We won't hear from Carrie, as I understand it, until the fall. But he is officially coming to us next week. And for that, we should be thankful, but we should also approach this horizon with understanding, and Hugh would say, with love. Well, I think I've convinced you that there's a gap. Call it tangible and intangible. Call it known and unknown. Call it today and the past and the future. There's a gap. And in that gap, we as human beings put stress. We put anxiety. But Jesus says, Who amongst you can add 1 year to his life by worrying? And tries to give us the comfortable message. It's trite to say that Jesus had the answer. I'd started out by saying this passage is both comforting and uncomfortable. It's trite to say that Paul has the answer in that beautiful passage, that beautiful, beautiful definition. And I know that I certainly don't have an answer. What I do know today, however, is that I would rather spend the time I have exploring my faith than worrying about controlling my future. Amen.